right.
Well, now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Bill comes to us from Clovis, so let's give a warm valley welcome to Bill from Clovis.
Thank you, Paul. My name's Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Almost forgot how to start there. Now, when Paul says we're going to have a moment of silence, he wasn't kidding, man. It took like a whole minute. I'm like, now I'm cool with that. I can do a whole minute now, or I'm serene, you know, I've been around long enough. But I was, in the beginning, I was not, man. I would just start the prayer. I said, God, you know, get everybody going, you know. But because I was so crazy, now when someone does that for a long time, I got to look out and look at people and see who's squirming, you know. Because I know there's a few of you that are squirming like I did. First, I want to thank Bill for asking me to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. This always does something to me when I get up and share with a bunch of people, you know, like when you share with one person, it does something. But when you do it with a whole group of alcoholics that are just like you, it does something else. It's really cool. I guess I'll start by telling you that I started drinking when I was 14, Bacardi 151. And I always think it's interesting, I can't tell you what my first soda was, but I can tell you what the first booze was. And I loved it, man. With me and a buddy, we split a pint, and we had a bottle of soda. We had enough money for a bottle of soda for a chaser. And we split the Bacardi and two little styrofoam cups, and we downed it best we could, and we said, hey, don't use too much of that chaser, you know, in case we need it, you know. So we just took a little bit of sips of the chasers that we could, and we both got it down. And I remember I was on Manhattan Beach Pier at the concrete pier, and I had a crack in the pier, and I stubbed my toe, and it ripped open the top of my big toe, and I couldn't feel it, and it was bleeding, and I just thought, that is so cool, man. 14 years old, you're impressed with little stuff like that. And I couldn't wait to drink again. It was fabulous. And the reason it was fabulous is because I think I was so dysfunctional with people. Relationships just messed me up. Everything made me nervous. Well, I'll tell you about my relationships a little bit in my story here, how they went when I was drinking. But even before I was drinking, I was an uncomfortable kid, you know. I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere. You know the old story. And drinking for me, I've heard drinking made me feel like I fit in. It didn't make me feel like I fit in at all, but it made me not care. I don't care if I fit in with you guys or not, you know. I'm here. Hey, let's drink. And I went to a lot of parties, high school parties. I was always out in the backyard. That's where the boozers and the dopers hung out. We didn't go inside. You know, we were dancing and having fun. We were outside, you know, puking in the bushes and drinking. And, man, that's what I did. I remember the prom. I didn't get dressed up. I went in my Levi's. We went out in the bushes and we drank. We didn't even go to dance, I don't think. Football games under the bleachers. I tried drugs. Drugs aren't a big part of my story. They were in high school for 4 years. But I know this is an AA meeting. I'm not going to get into that. But that was a part of my story. And I did a lot of drugs in high school. But when I got out of high school, I didn't chase drugs. Booze was enough for me. And so I don't even call myself an addict now, even though I took a lot of drugs. I smoked a lot of dope. My 19-year-old son got in a second accident today and wrecked the front of his car. It's going to cost some money. I told him, dude, you're taking the bus, man. You know, I wouldn't be much of a dad if I fixed your car for you and let you keep driving, man. You got to take the bus. And I said, I hate doing that to you. I really do. I hate it. I want him to have a car. I don't want him to have to get up an hour and a half early to make it to school and all this stuff anyway. But I shared with him a story about how when I wasn't much older than him, I was 26, 25, I was in Las Vegas, and I gambled my money away, and so I was broke, and I had to get back home, I needed gas money, so I had this winning ticket for $100 on a football game. So I went into the Mint, and I said, I want to cash this ticket. And, you know, this thing's open, they're taking bets and stuff. They said, we're not cashing tickets now. I said, what do you mean you're not cashing tickets? You're open. And he says, we're not. We're just taking money for bets. We're not cashing any in. And I got so mad, I drunk, and I knocked an ashtray over. Like, that's going to do something good or something, you know. And I walked away, you know, like, here, clean that up, you know. And then I didn't get it. I didn't get from there to the slot machines, and I was grabbed, man, by security. And I'm thinking, actually crossed my mind, if I punch this dude and run, I could probably make it out, you know. And I thought, no, you know, it's security. They'll probably just chew me out. Maybe they'll make me clean up the ashtray, and I'll go home. So I said, all right. So I went in there, and we're talking, and he's acting like they're going to let me go. And we talked maybe 10 minutes, and there was the Clark County Police Department there taking me to Clark County Jail. I thought, well, that wasn't a good plan. I should have probably punched them in there. Anyway, so I went to Clark County Jail. I was in there for 3 days over the weekend. They wheeled in this phone for you. Yeah, you had phone privileges, but you couldn't call long distance. I didn't know anybody in Las Vegas, you know. So, and it was weekend, you know, so the judge was, you know, closed, and so I had to wait for Monday to go see the judge. And so the public defender, he says, what's your story? You know, what happened? I said, well, I got a little unruly. I was arrested for disorderly conduct, but I wasn't arrested for drunken disorderly. I was maintained really well. I was ripped, drunk. But when the cops were there, I could talk and I slurred my words pretty good, no matter how ripped I was. Anyway, so I told a public defender, hey, you know, this is what happened. You know, I was trying to cash my ticket. They wouldn't cash the damn thing, so I got mad, you know. He says, oh, okay. And he says, how much is the ticket worth? I says, $100. He says, all right. So the judge says, how do you plead? And I said, guilty, Your Honor, and I'd like time served. I just spent 3 days in your jail. I'd like that to be the penalty. I'd like to ask you for that. And then the judge says, do you have any money? I said, no, sir, I'm broke. And my public defender says, he has a ticket worth $100. The judge says, fines $100. And man, I felt like punching him too, you know. And that was a resentment that I had to write the public defender's list a letter, you know, in Las Vegas because I didn't know who it was. So I wrote the office a letter and made my amends to those people because I hated that public defender, man. I thought, you're supposed to be on my side. You turned on me, man, you know, and that really affected me. Treason is bad for me. And anyway, I told my son that I had done that when I was 26, and I told him that I wrecked my dad's car a couple of times by the time I was your age. And I said, you're a good kid, you know. You're a little too aggressive driver, but you're a good kid. But I got to yank the car from you, man. Or else I wouldn't be a good parent. And man, he pretty much understood. Yeah, I know. And so he's going to be taking the bus. Anyway, but I share with him my stories about my alcoholism and about what kind of kid I was. He's a lot better kid than I was, and I got to let him know that. And that keeps me in check, too. Keeps me a little bit humble because I want to get mad at him every time he screws up. And I'm thinking, man, he's not screwing up near as bad as I did. He don't drink. He's tried it. And he tried marijuana and he doesn't smoke dope. And he didn't tell me for a whole year. I used to take him to meetings when he was a kid. And he didn't tell me for a whole year after that he tried these things. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? I thought we had a pretty open relationship. And he says, oh, Dad, you know how you always tell me how much it screws up your whole life and everything? He says, I didn't want you to worry. I thought, wow, okay, that's pretty cool, you know. So, but he hasn't done it since. He doesn't do that stuff. And I'm blessed, man. I'm blessed. And I didn't want him. I met a woman in AA. Now, that's the one thing I wanted to say. I was going to start off with this, and I forgot it. Regarding the insanity of the first drink, I can help people with that. I know how to do it because this book tells me. 164 simple little pages tell me how to do that. And even though they're simple, they seem really tough because the journey you have to take is inside, and we don't want to do that. And so all of a sudden, I don't even know what these words mean. What's all this, you know? Well, because we don't want to go where we know it takes us. And so we need a guide. And I can guide people in this. But as far as any other type of insanity, especially with women, I can't help you. I'm done, man. I'm sorry. I used to go... I didn't go into the finer places and drink. I rarely drank my booze out of a glass. And I've heard the term highball. I don't even know what a highball is. I know what a bottle of Jack Daniels is. I know what tequila is. I know what all these bottles are that you open a cap and you drink. But I don't do drinks. I don't know. I didn't do too many drinks. And so I used to stay home and drink. When I was young, you know, and I wanted to find a woman in my life, and but I didn't want to go to the bars and buy them drinks. So I'd stay home and drink and get drunk until 2 in the morning. Then I'd go out to Denny's. And, you know, and the women who wanted to keep it going, you know, and the guys already bought them drinks and got them drunk, so I didn't have to do that. So this is where I'd meet my mates in Denny's. And, that's where I met my wife. We met at a Denny's, and she said, "Do you want to come to my?" I said, "I'm out of town. I'm working. You know, I used to be in construction, repaired electrical generating stations, and so I did a lot of traveling." And I went to L.A., and she was in L.A., and "I don't have a place to stay." And she says, "Well, you can come over to my place." I said, "Oh, well, that's a good idea." And so I went over to her place. But I was so dysfunctional. I could never do more than one night. If I went and stayed overnight with a lady, that was it. Boom, I'm out of there, man, because it was too much like friendship, relationship stuff the next day. I couldn't do it, man. It scared me. I just couldn't do it. I was real dysfunctional in that area. Oh, and I was. And so anyway, she says, "Come back tomorrow night, or tonight," and the next morning. And I said, "Oh, yeah, sure," like I usually did, you know, and I wasn't planning on going. And then I couldn't find a room again, you know, so I called her up and, "Hey, that offer, you know, is it still standing?" She says, "Yeah, come on over." So I ended up staying there a few nights and a couple of weeks, turned into a couple of weeks. And then she says, "My dad's a trucker, and he's coming through town. And he's not going to like you staying here like this." I said, "Oh, well, okay, what do you want to do?" And she says, "Well, if we told him that we were engaged, it'd be okay." So I'm like, "All right, go ahead, you know, I don't care." And it wasn't. A few weeks later, we're in Las Vegas and we're getting married, man. That's the way I lived. I drank and I just, whatever, you know. And we got married, and I don't know if I was, I don't know what I was thinking. But with that, we got the suite in the Four Queens. And so I go down gambling, and we had a bar. There was a bar set up, and we had gallons of every booze there was. And her uncle or somebody was a bartender, so we asked him to tend bar for us, you know, and everybody was drinking. He was pouring, you know, shots and everything. And we got plastered. Anyway, I went down and started gambling, and for some reason, the dealer didn't like me. And I didn't think he was very nice either. But when you're in Las Vegas and the dealer don't like you, you know, don't work out so good for the customer. And so I was getting escorted out of the place by the guards. And I looked at the guards. I said, "Man, you can't kick me out of here. I got the wedding suite, you know. Like, I'm the big wheel, you know." And so they kind of said, "Well, okay." I said, "I just got married, man." And they said, "All right, well, you got to go to your room. We're going to take you to your room." And there's two guards, you know, and escorting me to my room. And by the time I got up to the room, I was so angry that I started tearing the drapes down. And I was tearing this place apart. And it was my wife's first wedding. And she came out of the other room and she says, "What the hell are you doing?" And then I got mad at her and I pushed her on the bed and I started popping these buttons out of the back of the bed while I was on top of her to bring all this trauma close to her. I was insane. And then yet when I got in here and the second step said restore you to sanity, I thought, I was a little offended that they would call me insane. What the hell? And I was crazy. I was a crazy person. I never did any time in prison. I never did any real time in jail either, but after that, I seen the inside of several jails. I couldn't stop getting arrested, you know, disorderly conduct usually, or small time possession of drugs. You know, I always seemed to have those hanging around. My eyes aren't so good. I'm trying to see back there. I always want to keep an eye on the time here. How far do I go? 5 to 8. So I got married, and we stayed married 10 years, from 26 to 36, and 36 is when I got sober. And I I went to this, just before I got sober, I went to this job in L.A., and we needed money real bad. We were busted, man. I didn't work much. And I just drank. I drank a lot. And then so I took this job in L.A., and I go down there, and I'm working. It's a two-week job, and it's round-the-clock working. And we're making a ton of money. And I worked 1 week, and I got paid. And to celebrate, I went to the bar, and I closed the bar. And then the next day, I went back to that bar, and I didn't go to work, and I closed the bar again. And I did that 3 days. And it was only a two-week job. And I already worked a week, and there's only a few days left in my job. So I called my wife up, and I said, "Hey, I got to quit." And she's like, "Why you got to quit? We need the money." And I said, it's just not working, because I knew they were going to fire me. And she said, she was real calm. And after all these years, she knew who I was. I was an ass to her, I wasn't very nice. And she was just like fed, beyond fed up. It was just like white rage, It was just like calm, Like Clint Eastwood's kind of calm, angry, And she says, "Why are you so depressed?" And I said, "I don't know." She was a nurse, and she says, "Alcohol is a depressant, and maybe it's all the booze you drink." And I said, "No, baby." I said, "Booze makes me feel better. I need the booze." And she says, "Well, it's a depressant." She explained it all to me, in clinical terms and all that. And then she says, "Every time you hit me, you're always blackout drunk." And that got me, because I was very ashamed that I had ever done that to my wife. I didn't do it very often, but I did. And not very often is way too much. One time is too much to strike a woman. And so I had real deep shame about that. And I drank it away, of course. And I excused it away and whatever I did to not look at that, to be in denial. And when she said that, it was like, boom. The truth just hit me, man. And then she said, "Why don't you try quitting for 30 days and see if you feel better?" And she said it real calmly, and so I was accepting of her idea, and I thought, well, maybe that's a good idea. As soon as I thought that, I thought, holy shit, I can't go tomorrow morning without a drink. I knew I can't do it. And that's the first time that I ever knew that I couldn't stop. Because I never in my life considered stopping. Not once. This is I'm Irish. It's my right. And, everybody's got to understand. And, all that crap that goes on in your head. I never considered stopping drinking. That's just the way you live. And if you didn't go to jail once in a while, if you just went to work and went home and watched TV and did that all the way till you died, retired and died, you didn't know how to live. I go to jail once in a while. That's because it's evidence that I'm out there living a life. That's what I believe. And, I was sick. I took my wife out to the desert. We lived out in the desert in a trailer park. And I joined this guy out there. I met this guy out there. He was a tax revolter. And he said, "You don't got to pay tax. It's unconstitutional." And he showed me all this shit to back it up. And it sounded pretty good, It says in their own tax code, taxes are based on voluntary compliance. Well, later it was explained to me, stopping for a red light is based on voluntary compliance. But if you don't stop, you're going to get a ticket. Well, if you don't pay taxes, you're going to, that's just going to happen. Well, I worked 5 years, I didn't file my taxes. And every job I went on, I would do exempt. If you go exempt, the employer won't pay any taxes in for you to the federal government. They can't take your taxes. So I said, put me exempt. I'm taking that money. Because when I work these long hours. And we made a bunch of money per week. And then like 3-4 weeks, we get laid off. But we made a bunch of money. Well, when you make that kind of money, it's like you make that money all year. They tax you like half your paycheck, I was getting fed up with that shit. I said, "Nah, put me exempt." And so I was doing that on every job. And then we'd only be a little while. The IRS never caught up to me. And then we get laid off and go to another job. And so I kept doing that for 5 years. And then they arrested my tax revolt president. He went to Boron Prison out in the desert. And I said, "Well, that son of a bitch, man." He said he couldn't get arrested, And so I quit doing that. I started paying my taxes again. But I had those 5 years kind of trailing behind me. And the IRS would be sending me these liens all the time saying, you can't own nothing that we don't have a lien on, in a general lien. And I found out you can do a bankruptcy on old tax debt. So I went to this lawyer and I paid for the bankruptcy and I did it. I got the bankruptcy papers and then I sent them into the IRS. I said, I did a bankruptcy, you give me a release of lien. Sure enough, they sent me a release of lien, man, you can do it. And so I never paid the IRS. And I'm clean now. But one of my sponsors said, you know, you used the roads all those years, and your military was out there defending your country for you, and you used all those things those tax dollars would have paid, but you didn't pay. So maybe societally you don't owe that money, but spiritually, I want you to consider paying them. I haven't paid them yet. I'm 24 years sober. I haven't paid them yet. But I do what the book says. I'm open. I'm not saying I will never make that amends. I'm open to that. One day I might make that amends. It's been good enough for me so far. And then other people say, no, that this other book, that me and this other guy read, the big, big book, we call it, says in there that you do what Caesar says. And in this case, Caesar says bankruptcy is okay. You don't have to pay. So I don't know what to do with that. I pray God will direct me. But so I went and bought 1,000 rounds of ammunition. So when the IRS came for me, I'm going to shoot it out with them. I'm going to be a true American, and I'm shooting it out with the IRS. And I was serious, man. I got this ammo, and I'm barricading in the desert. Man, I'm living like a pack rat in the desert. And I'm dragging this poor woman with me. And she stuck with me, thick and thin, man. She stuck with me. I used to go from work. I'd go to the bar, and I wouldn't call. I'm just going to go for a couple, you know, tell the guys. We'd go to the bar, and we'd be drinking. And then maybe 10 guys would go down to maybe 5. And pretty soon it's just you and this other hardcore drinker dude. And you drink, and then you notice, oh, shit, man, it's 8 o'clock. Well, I'm not calling her now. She's going to be mad. And I looked up, oh, well, shit, 2 o'clock. I guess I got to go home, you know. And I go home. Well, I had the type of Al-Anon. There's no Al-Anons in the room. I had you know how it's amazing how we could pick out the Al-Anon, the alcoholic. It's amazing. This woman would get out of bed, go to the refrigerator, take out the meal she cooked for me at 6 o'clock, and heat it up for me so I could eat it at 2 o'clock. I know. Wow. One time I was working in Oxnard on a job, and I had my motorcycle, and I'm riding back, and we lived in Rosamond, which is near Mojave. And for those of you not familiar with the desert, you know, it's hot in the summertime, but in the winter, it gets white with frost. It's freezing in the desert, in the high desert in Mojave. And I was riding my bike, and it was raining, and it was freezing cold wintertime. I used to stop every 10 miles to warm up, and then pretty soon I figured, shit, I'll just freeze again in the next 2 miles I get on the bike, you know? So I just toughed it out and went home. And by the time I got home, my whole body was shaking. I would never been that cold, I don't think, in my life. I was all wet. She took my clothes off, dried me off, and then she took her clothes off, and she got in bed with me, and she cuddled me. Her warm body against mine, I had to be like an ice cube. And I was so dysfunctional. Here's the point I'm trying to make. I was so dysfunctional, I didn't think, wow, it feels good to be loved that much. I thought, that woman's nuts. That's insanity, man. That's crazy. And it's because I didn't know how to accept love. I wasn't worthy of love. I was small, man. I was small in this big world. I was a little kid, and I didn't understand it. And when it hurt my feelings, it pissed me off. You pissed me off. I was an angry dude. And I remember I met this lady in AA. We started dating, and we were both fairly new. And she comes over to my house, and she goes into the closet one day, and she sees my ammo boxes. She opened it up. She goes, what the hell is this? I said, well, you've heard me in AA share that story about the 1,000 rounds for the IRS. She says, you mean that's real? She thought that was my bullshit AA story, you know? And I said, yeah, I did that. And anyway, she stuck around, too. And my sponsor, we were friends. We were just friends. I don't know if you've ever heard that in AA. You know, just be friends. And so I go to this new sponsor, I said, I'm friends with this lady. And he goes, oh, yeah? And he says, well, is she bettable? I said, what? He says, is this somebody that you would have sex with? Do you find her sexy? And I said, hey, I'm taking a little offense to this. I told you this is my friend, this lady, you know. And he said, I'd just like to know if you find her sexy, that's all. And I said, well, I guess she is, yeah, but I don't look at her that way. And he says, okay, give me any offense. She says, I just have a hard time with the men lady friend thing. She says, I have a hard time with that, that's all. And sure enough, she ended up having my son, who just got in the car wreck today. And so I don't know about that lady friend thing either, you know. I think I would be up in myself. I didn't want a friend. I wanted more than a friend. But we were creeping up on it. And I find that when we say we're going to be friends, all that means is I want control of when it's going to happen. You know, and it ain't now. So we're just friends. So anyway, that's my experience. I don't know. I'm not going to tell anybody anything about that. I just share my experience, if I can help. And if that helps somebody, cool. And if you can use my example as, man, that is crazy, I'm not going to do that. Cool. If it works for you, if that helps you through it, that's good. I'm good with that. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was new, I kept thinking this ain't real. The sobriety world is a completely different world. I loved it. I was going to conventions. I had this camper, big old camper, and had a boat. And so I would come to the meetings and get about four or five guys, and we'd get in my camper, and we'd drive off to a convention in Sacramento and Monterey and all these conventions. And I was like digging it, man. We're staying up all night in guys' rooms and playing cards and everything. It was all great, man. I was loving AA. And then with the boat, me and this other guy, we buddied up. We were both new. And we went to three meetings a day, and we go to coffee shops, and we talk about spiritual stuff, and all the stuff we're reading and everything. We were like really taken with AA and all the spiritual stuff. And but then we'd go into a new meeting, and we write on these little pieces of paper, a few of us are going to the lake, would you like to go, you know, for the afternoon? And then we'd hand them to the ladies that we liked in the meeting. And we get a boat full, and then we take them up to Millerton, and we go and have a good time for the afternoon, and then we come back, make the 5:30 meeting, and I was loving life, man. It was great. Sobriety was really good. But I kept thinking, this ain't going to last. This ain't real. It can't be real for me. I'm a drunk. Like, I'm different from everybody in here. And I just thought, man, I'm going to fail this program. It's not going to work. And even when I got 9 months, that's a long time to be sober. I got 9 months and I thought, you know what? I just did 9 months. I feel pretty good. I'm going to make a whole year, get a year chip, and then I'll go back to my old life. And then when I got a year and I took that cake, my sponsor told me, go take a cake and I'll get up there and celebrate. And I didn't know that a guy screwed up his youth and they'd make a whole year. So I did. And then I realized, holy crap, I don't want to drink. What am I thinking? I actually got myself convinced I was going to drink. That's how crazy I am. In sobriety, my brain can be crazy. I can go into denial about stuff and maneuver my life through that denial. And then when the reality comes and slaps me later, it hurts. And that's what my sobriety has been, a series of that. Learning and getting hurt by the reality that I deny. And that's the way I read the book. It tells me that's what I do. And that's why I got to get back. My sponsor reminds me all the time. It says in the book, we are in the world to play the role he assigns, God assigns. And he's asking me all the time, Bill, what role are you assigning yourself regarding this? This thing that disturbs you, what role are you assigning yourself? Well, an intimidator. I want to make them scared of me so they'll do what I want. So is that the role God's assigning you? No. You're not entitled to that role. He tells me, you're not entitled to your next breath. That's a blessing from God. All this other stuff, you're not entitled to it. Whenever I'm disturbed, something wrong with me, that was said in the 12 and 12, I used to argue with that so much. And now I see, whenever I'm disturbed, I want entitlement to something that's not mine. The world ain't mine. God has the world going the way He wants it to go. It's not mine. I'm not entitled to any changes in the world. I'm not entitled to changes in you. I was going to Al-Anon for a while, and they told me if you make a suggestion one time, that's a loving thing to do. If you make it two times, you're controlling and manipulating. Man, I made it a lot more than two times, a lot. And I try to change people. Who do I think I am that I can change you? Or if I treat you really nice, I expect you to treat me back nice. Who do I think I am that because I act a certain way, I'm going to change your whole character and who you are? You won't steal from me because I'm treating you good. No, that's not true. If you're a thief, you're going to steal from me. I don't care how good I treat you. That's what happens in life. But I would get all upset about that. I'd be disturbed and have to run to my sponsor. And he'd show me, man, you're not entitled to that, Bill. And I kept thinking I was entitled to things. I'm bigger than life, man. I get all this stuff. I thought I was big as Philip. No, he's not back there. I like Philip with his big head when he come up here. That was good. My phone keeps on blacking out. I mean, I have to push the button. Okay, 7:45. I got about 10 minutes. There's a couple of things I don't want to miss, so I'm going to read right now from the book. On page 570, it's in Dispersal Experience. It says, because I'm explaining to you how I always thought that I was going to fail this program, and I never really got it. It took me about 9 months to a year before I really sunk in where it says, none of us, and it really hit me, not one person in the room is able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. Not one of us are doing this anything like perfectly. We're all fumbling through this thing. I always thought I was the only one. I was the only one who had to run to my sponsor all the time. This little babysitter arrangement I have with my sponsor. I hated it. I hated sponsor stuff. And because I thought the man knows how to get through life on his own. Well, no. He reminded me, presidents have like 50 advisors. Those are like sponsors. You can't have one. And I thought, yeah, wow. I never saw myself as playing a role of God. I never saw that before. And that's what I do. To think that I can't have an advisor and kick life off with him, bounce stuff off with him. To think that I can't do that and have an advisor, who am I? That's what I thought. I thought it was a weak person that needed that. I had a hard time accepting this whole program. But I accept it totally today. This is the way to stay sober. But I want to tell you, if you're having a hard time, you think that maybe you can't make it, I want to tell you this. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. Belligerent denial is my big one, man. I have that. And I maneuver my life around my denial, and I cause myself great pain. And it'd be nice if I could say, you guys don't have to do that. Just don't have this belligerent denial. But man, I keep getting it back, and I said, it's tough. I got to keep on working the steps and seeing where I've done that and making amends and then doing it right the next time. And I got to keep doing that over and over. It's a design for living, meaning just don't get done. This is who I am. I'm an alcoholic. I screw up. I have belligerent denial. I have intolerance, an attitude of intolerance. I have that. I get it. I got to have a sponsor, and I got to work this stuff through. There's another thing on page 55 that took me a long time before I really heard this too. Because I kept thinking I was going to fail. Here it says you cannot fail if you do this. We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourage you to search diligently within yourself, those three things. Then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. That's like a promise. You cannot fail. All you got to do is those three things. That's all. Those are hard, man. Search diligently within yourself. Give that a shot, man. Work the fourth step and go share yourself with another human being. Man, there's nothing tough about it. The fourth step, I tell my guys that I work with, I say, look, here's an inventory right here. Mr. Brown, he's pissed at Mr. Brown because he pays attention to his wife. I said, how mad would you be if some dude was paying attention to your wife? That gets you pretty upset. Next one is, he told my wife of my mistress. Now how mad are you? You're ready to shoot this Mr. Brown. And then it says, Brown may get my job at the office. Holy crap, what else is this Brown going to do to me? So that's big stuff. And I tell my guys, look, I can't imagine you being more upset with somebody than this dude. And look how much paper that takes. You don't have to write a book, man. This takes about an inch and a half. Mr. Brown. So this is not a big assignment. The actual assignments we get in this, I call them assignments, the actual assignments we get here are small, man. I said, when they get all done, I said, all right, now tell me, with that four step, all that writing you got, how much actual time pushing that pencil do you think you spend? Oh, I don't know, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours. Some guys, 4. I said, well, let's stretch it out. Let's say 5 or 6. I said, 5 or 6 hours, it took you, what, a month to do that? Your four step? For 5 or 6 hours, actual labor? I said, man, we want to make it out. Like, you're killing these spots, you know? And it's like, no, it's not that big. It's inside. We don't want to take the trip inside. It's hard. It's simple, but it's not easy. You hear that? Well, the not easy part is you got to go inside. You got to be honest. You got to get rid of that belligerent denial. And you got to be honest with yourself and say, this is who I am. And then when you get in that fourth column, man, and you cannot look at what they did. You can't excuse yourself with, well, they did this to me. No, you just look at this. This is you, dude. And we're just resolutely looking at you. Man, that's hard. When I was done with my fifth step, my sponsor said, is that the guy you want to be? I'm like, hell no. I don't want to be that. Liar, cheat, and thief. That's not, I've never wanted to be that. I was, but I didn't want to be. And he said, well, there's a way to change. And it takes a lifetime. But you get better all the time as you go. And I also want to say, too, that I don't know where it is in here, but it says, because I'm up here, if I was down there and talking to somebody, I could think of it right away, but it says, too, that just read it today, too. Let me see if I find it. I think it's Roman numeral 17. I was working with my new guy today, and we went over this. First step. This is great stuff. Yeah, it's not there. It's on another page. But anyway, and I'm sure most of you heard it because it's in the beginning of the book. It says that for us to live, for us to be sober, we have to, what's it called? Self-sacrifice. Work and self-sacrifice. Somewhere in the beginning of the book. We need to work and self-sacrifice. I said, how does self-sacrifice sound to you? I said, sounds pretty shitty to me. I don't want self-sacrifice. And I said, but you know what? My meeting you here right now, after my son was in a wreck, I had to push his car, I had to do all that shit with his car, I missed my noon meeting that I like to go to, and then I had to meet him at 1:30. And I said, I got to speak tonight. And after we're done, I got to go rush home, shower, rush over to the Tower District, meet my biker buddies, and ride down here. And I said, I only got like 4 hours, 5 hours sleep last night, so I'm kind of tired. I kind of want to get a nap. But I'm not napping. I'm here talking to you, helping you. I said, you know why? Because I want to stay sober, man. Because the book says I have to work and self-sacrifice. And it's really not that big a deal. I want to say, look what I'm doing. Look what I got to do. It's nothing, man. And just look at what Bill does. I don't even do that. Fantastic. And Bill stays sober. Because he works and self-sacrifice for this program, for other alcoholics to stay sober. And if you do that, if you do what it says on top page 20, our very lives, this means I'm going to die if I don't do this, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Help meet someone else's needs. That's it. This is a cure for alcoholism. That's it. And the rest of the book tells us how to do that. Tells us how to clear all that crap out, that selfish crap that I had, that ruined my wife's wedding night, that got arrested, that didn't give a shit about anybody. It tells me how to change that. And as I'm changing that, I notice I'm staying sober. That's what the book tells me. I never would have thought of that as a cure for alcoholism. It's amazing. It also says, too, I want to say the most important part of the book. It says, above everything. That would mean, number one, the most important thing. Above everything, we must be rid of this selfishness or it kills us. There's another thing. I'm going to die if I don't do it. And it all relates to getting out of self and helping another alcoholic. I want to thank you very much for letting me share with you tonight.